Josh Hastings here, Israel Uncensored, on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com. Thanks so much for joining us. This is a special edition of the show for Friday, September 7th, 2018. Normally, we come out with my program on the Land of Israel Network on Mondays, but we have an extremely special guest, a very special guest here on the line, and we decided we're going to come out with the show on Friday. Jason Greenblatt, assistant to U.S. President Donald Trump and the special representative for international negotiations. He joins us now. It is truly an honor, Jason, to have you on the show.
Thank you, Josh. I'm really excited to be here. Thank you for taking the time to interview me.
Thank you for taking the time. We know you're extremely busy, so we are going to get right to it with some of the questions I have for you here today. How do you view the overall relationship at this point between the U.S. and Israel under the current Trump administration?
I think that the relationship between the United States and Israel has never been stronger. And I don't think we've ever had a president more supportive of the state of Israel. And I think that it's clear that the support is returned by Israelis who have clearly expressed their appreciation to President Trump for his policies relating to Israel. He's done something no other president had the courage to do. He recognized the reality that Jerusalem is and always will be Israel's capital. And he finally moved the United States Embassy to Jerusalem, where it always belonged. Probably the best way I can end this answer to your question is by quoting a friend of mine who everybody in Israel knows well and does a terrific job here in Washington, D.C., representing the state of Israel, Ambassador Ron Dermer, who recently said in a speech at a Christians United for Israel event, and I quote, "There has never been a U.S. administration more supportive of Israel than the Trump administration. Frankly, it's not even close," he said.
Well, I would subscribe to Ambassador Dermer's comments, and we feel it over here, and we really, really appreciate it. We feel the love. We feel the support. So I thank you for that. Moving ahead, without getting into specific details, I know you can't do that. What makes this attempt at peace, it's all over the news now, between Israel and the Palestinians fundamentally different than previous attempts, in your opinion?
Well, first of all, let me thank you for not asking for specific details. you're unique in starting your question that way. I usually have to start the interview by saying I'm not going to give you any details. So I appreciate that very much.
No problem. We're going to skip all that. My pleasure.
So I think our plan begins with reality. It recognizes the history of the conflict, of course, but it avoids relying on tired notions of what should be, and instead it focuses on what could be. Our plan isn't just a two-page term sheet. It's an extensive document that we've developed that explains how we think the conflict can be resolved. It lays out each issue and proposed solutions very clearly so both sides could understand beyond an aspirational term sheet, what the solutions really are and whether they are going to be willing to live with those proposed solutions. It's the result of extensive consultation with Israelis, Palestinians from before the Jerusalem announcement, because at the moment Palestinian leadership is not talking to us, much to their detriment, I would add. It's also after extensive conversation with regional leaders and other stakeholders. And all of their questions and concerns have helped us forge a plan into a deal that we think is realistic, fair, and equally important, implementable.
So we're going to have to wait and see the specifics as they come out, when they come out. But I'm going to turn my attention now to Syria. There's actually a much more serious conflict, some might feel, I certainly agree with it, continuing to rage in that country. Why is the U.S. focusing efforts on resolving, which is a relatively calm conflict in the West Bank, as some people call it, in which there is security cooperation right now between Israelis and Palestinians as we speak?
Jared, David, and I have been charged by the president to try to achieve a comprehensive peace deal between Israelis and Palestinians. That's our mandate. And I understand that serious people may be skeptical about whether or not we could reach a peace agreement, a comprehensive peace agreement. And I think that's very understandable. But I think there are very few people in the world that would oppose an attempt at finding a solution. And while it's true that there are other conflicts in the region, And as I've said many times, this is certainly not the core conflict in the region, as others have said. We think that there are unique circumstances now that warrant an attempt at trying to see whether or not we can do this. And President Trump, as devoted and dedicated to the state of Israel and the Jewish people as he is also dedicated to trying to help the Palestinian people. And the way we can marry those two ideas is by trying to reach this comprehensive peace agreement.
So then in the same vein, we've seen this in recent weeks, the Trump administration has announced a series of cuts to the Palestinian Authority, funding for UNRWA. What is the goal by making those cuts? And do you think this will help urge the Palestinians to come back to the negotiation table?
I think there's a couple of things I have to unpack in that question. So the first is that earlier this year, the president directed a review of U.S. assistance to the Palestinian Authority, as well as to the West Bank and Gaza, to ensure that the funds were being spent in accordance with U.S. national interests and also providing value to the U.S. taxpayer. From that review and at the direction of the president, we're going to be, as was announced a few weeks ago, redirecting more than $200 million of fiscal year 2017 economic support funds that were originally planned for programs in the West Bank and Gaza, and instead those are going to go to higher priority projects elsewhere. And I want to make clear that that decision is separate from, but also consistent with, Congress's purpose in passing the Taylor Force Act, which restricts assistance to the Palestinian Authority unless the Palestinian Authority ends the abhorrent practice of payments to imprison terrorists and the families of terrorists. And let's move over now to UNRWA, because as you probably are aware, last week we made an announcement regarding UNRWA, and there's a few points that I want to make about UNRWA. First of all, it's been clear for years that UNRWA's model of operations is completely unsustainable. And we've said repeatedly that UNRWA needs to seek out new voluntary funding streams. They need to increase their burden sharing among donors, and they also have to find ways to reduce their expenditures. A little bit of progress has been made, but as the current situation demonstrates, not nearly enough progress. We also made it clear back in January when we made our $60 million contribution that the U.S. is no longer willing to shoulder a disproportionate share of UNRWA's costs while other donors lag behind and they don't match their rhetoric with real-world action. Our $60 million contribution that we made back in January still makes the United States one of UNRWA's most generous donors for 2018. I'll point out and praise that Jordan, Egypt, and Sweden, and other stakeholders have encouraged burden sharing, better burden sharing, and others have stepped forward. But at the end of the day, the international community did not prove itself willing to fix this problem. UNRWA is nearly out of funds, and it's time, in our view, to have everybody acknowledge that their business operation is a failing model. It's tied to an endlessly and exponentially expanding community of beneficiaries. It's unsustainable. It operates in permanent crisis mode. And we have decided to no longer commit to funding this irredeemably flawed operation. We also believe that Palestinians deserve better than this crisis-driven model. They, wherever they live, they deserve to plan for their future and the future of their children. We're mindful of the impact on innocent Palestinians, including school children. And we're ready to engage with other governments in the region and elsewhere to see if we can transition UNRWA services to other governments or international organizations. We welcome to participate in that conversation. But I want to stress again that we view UNRWA's model as irredeemably flawed.
Well, last week I actually did a whole show about UNRWA, so I would encourage the audience, if you missed that show and you want to hear my take on UNRWA, go back and listen to the last week's edition of Israel Uncensored here. I'm not going to give my opinions now. Go back and listen to that show. We want to hear from Jason here. I did a little homework on some of the recent articles you've had published, and in your August 9th CNN op-ed, which was titled "Israelis and Palestinians Must Unite Against Shared Threat," you call Hamas, quote, "an Islamic fundamentalist terror organization," unquote, which seeks to destroy Israel while at the same time you call on the Palestinians in Gaza to choose peace. How is it possible to put the Palestinians in Gaza on a path towards peace as long as Hamas continues to rule over their lives while neglecting their interests?
Great question. And if you don't mind, before I answer that specific question, because you were kind enough to give me this platform by pointing to an op-ed, I want to address the news media issue on this file.
Please.
There's a lot of speculation and rumors going around, and in particular in the last couple of weeks, about what we're doing, what's in the plan, and so on and so forth. The best way for people to understand our thoughts, our approach, what's in the plan, which, you know, that won't get revealed anytime soon necessarily, but where we're going with it, is to just watch direct information from the administration, whether for me, Jared, David, others. Nikki Haley had some comments this week about our plan. We find that we're entering this, what I call an exciting period, because it's the pre-launch period, but it's also driving people to start getting nervous and creating a whole bunch of stories that aren't true. So the reason we've been writing these op-eds, and I don't know how much you watch what I'm doing, but we are also sort of hitting the road a little bit and starting to talk to groups about what we're trying to achieve, is because we want to give people as much information as we can without allowing people to spoil our effort. But the right way to do that is what you did, which is look at what's truly coming out of the administration as opposed to what certain newspaper articles say that have happened or will happen, or, you know, most of them turn out not to be true. But to answer your specific question now about Hamas, and I was a little bit surprised when I started on this file how little attention was paid to Hamas in Gaza. Most people spend a lot of time just talking about various catchwords and phrases and slogans that have been used on this file over the years without focusing that at the end of the day, if we don't resolve the situation in Gaza, it will be an obstacle on the road to peace. So separate from the humanitarian issue, and I feel terrible about what the Palestinians in Gaza are going through, Hamas itself is an obstacle on the road to peace. It's not a secret that and our view very much is, that the Palestinians of Gaza are hostage to Hamas, and they suffer terribly under Hamas's iron fist rule. It's also not a secret, in my opinion, that Hamas bears the ultimate responsibility for that suffering, and, excuse me, much to the detriment of the Palestinians in Gaza, many countries will not admit that out loud, although they certainly tell me that in private meetings. But the Palestinians of Gaza are not monolithic, and there are Palestinians in Gaza who would rather seek peace instead of launching violent protests and rockets and burning kites with swastikas adorned on them. And we're just going to have to work very, very hard to reach that population. And we think we can. And, of course, you know, we have to. There's no way around that. There's no way around that. We must do that.
So while we're on the topic of Hamas, is there a major risk if Israel decides to give up important tracts of land, let's say, in a peace deal, and afterwards the PA, as was the case in Gaza, is replaced by Hamas? Is there a huge risk that they would then not live up to their side of the bargain?
So without getting into the specific details, I will tell you this very, very clearly. Mm-hmm. This administration is absolutely committed to Israel's security, and we very much believe that the plan that we developed clearly reflects that. Ultimately, both sides are going to have to be comfortable with the plan. When I say be comfortable, among the things that they'll have to be comfortable with is Israel is going to have to be comfortable that what we put forth in the plan does not put Israel at risk. And we think we've devised a plan that takes all of Israel's security issues. And there are many, as you know far better than me. And we take that into account. When we reveal the plan, the security experts are going to digest it, and they're either going to confirm that we did the right job and took everything into account, or if we didn't, we're going to listen to their comments and concerns, as we will listen to all comments and concerns about it. But we will not put forth a plan or endorse a plan that doesn't meet all of Israel's security issues, because they're of extreme importance to us.
Yeah, on that same note, and I quoted your op-ed before, now I'd like to quote President Trump himself. On August the 21st, President Trump was at a rally in Charleston, West Virginia. He said that Israel would pay a, quote, higher price, unquote, in future talks with the Palestinians as a result of the U.S. recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital and the moving of the embassy. The president added the Palestinians, quote, again, will get something very good because it's their turn next, unquote. What is that higher price and what is in store for the Palestinians, especially at this juncture? As you mentioned before, their leadership isn't talking to the administration and they're threatening to thwart any U.S.-led peace plan.
So we think what we have developed is the best opportunity for a fair deal for both sides. There are parts of the plan that Israel is going to love, and then there are parts that Israel is not going to like. And the same is true for the Palestinians. So what we want people to ask themselves after reading the plan is, will we be better off with this plan or continuing without it? We think both sides are going to gain a lot more than they give. But to answer your question specifically, and I didn't discuss this specific comment with President Trump, but I believe that he meant that if we're lucky enough to have both sides negotiating our plan in good faith, we hope that Israel will take into account President Trump's good faith efforts in advancing the goal of peace. His recognition of Jerusalem, though, and the moving of the embassy was not intended to exact a price out of Israel. There's no particular demand on Israel in exchange for those decisions.
So let me ask you this. Another media item in which you spoke out, and also Ambassador Friedman was involved in the story. I'm talking about 31-year-old Israeli Yotam Ovadia of blessed memory, who was murdered in the community of Adam, just outside of Jerusalem last month by a Palestinian terrorist. You asked the following on Twitter, quote, "When will President Abbas and the Palestinian leaders condemn the violence?" Unquote. A few days later, you defended Ambassador Friedman for visiting Ovadia's widow after he was condemned by the PA for doing so. You added that it was, quote, not surprising that no condemnation over the attack itself had been issued. What does that say to you about the U.S. ability to work with the current PA leadership?
So I think David's and my tweets do speak for themselves, and I think what happened was outrageous. However, I will point out that we are ready to work with the current PA leadership if the PA leadership is ready to leave. That does mean condemning terror. It means fully engaging with our peace plan in good faith. I'll remind everybody that no one loses more than the Palestinian people when their leadership condemns a plan that they've never seen. No one loses more than them when the leadership falsely claims they've killed a plan that hasn't even seen the light of day yet. And no one loses more than them if their leadership will refuse to engage on the peace plan when it is revealed.
However, that being said, in the same vein, since Oslo, and here we are 25 years later, this month, the PA, and I don't have to tell you this, has systematically incited its population through the state media, schools, textbooks, public speeches, glorification of martyrs, and sponsorship of terrorism, including the PA's Pay for Slay program, which President Abbas says he'll continue to implement despite bills passed both in the U.S. and in Israel to prevent it. What makes you think the Palestinian people are prepared to enter into a peace accord?
We do believe that many Palestinians want to live in peace and they want to see their lives improved. They want to see their lives improved, by the way, even before a peace accord would be reached, but certainly after a peace accord. If we're wrong, then we're going to fail as others have failed before us. But I would say that we owe it to Israelis and Palestinians to try our utmost to see if we could finally achieve a peace deal. And I firmly believe that under today's circumstances that we find ourselves in, for so many reasons, that history will judge us if we don't try.
So, specifically, Mahmoud Abbas, can the man one day become a partner for peace?
I certainly hope that President Abbas chooses to engage with the peace plan, and I hope that he decides to lead his people to a better and brighter future, which is what this plan could bring the people. I think that working with the Trump administration is President Abbas's best opportunity to possibly achieve many of the goals that he has set out for himself and his people. And without engaging on the peace plan, there's not only not going to be any such opportunity, but the Palestinian people will fall further and further behind. Moreover, the condemnation of the peace plan, the continued condemnation of the peace plan, is going to yield no solution whatsoever to the Palestinian people. So our hope is that, yes, he will realize when he sees the plan that he should become a partner for peace.
So taking now the region, the Middle East, into account when talking about a future peace plan, how does Israel's new status as a regional, economic, technological, military superpower change Israel's bargaining position in any peace negotiations?
I wouldn't describe it as bargaining position. What I see relevant there is Israel's success over the last 70 years has been nothing short of amazing. And I think it should stand as an example to Palestinians and the region of what they could achieve if their leaders engage on the peace plan and let us help them help themselves. And we have spent a great deal of time, not just on the political aspects of the peace plan, but also on the economic portions of the peace plan. It's important for us to point out that the peace agreement itself is not the end of the road. It's the day after and the years after. So we have spent a great deal of time figuring out what happens post-peace agreement. And obviously a big component of that is the economy. And I think that the Palestinians can see what Israel has accomplished. And I hope that they want that for themselves as well. That's not to say they were pushing an economic peace. We're certainly not, and we understand that the Palestinians will not accept an economic peace. So I want to be clear that our plan is not an economic peace. It is a comprehensive peace, but of course it focuses on the economy because that's so important to a successful peace agreement.
Will then any peace deal need approval from regional partners such as Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan? Is that something that is needed in order to achieve this comprehensive plan that you're discussing today?
Approval is a strong word. I think that the only real path forward to a peace deal is direct negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. I do think that the regional partners are key players in our efforts, and we have done extensive consultations throughout the region and throughout our process. We're also hopeful that we could count on their support, and I use the word support rather than approval, so that they could help the Palestinians achieve a better future. So I think they're essential. I think they will be helpful. I hope they will be helpful. But I would not use the word approval. If I can, before I wish everyone a Shana Tova as well, might I just add one point that I'm
sure
I really want everyone?
Please.
The advice that I would give everybody, Israelis, Palestinians, everybody else who's interested in this file, is wait until the plan is released. And when it's released, please read it cover to cover. Judge the plan on its merits, not on rumors, not on speculation, not on news reports of what's in it. Really read it. We hope that once Israelis and Palestinians in the region and everybody else who wants to help read it, that Israelis and Palestinians are going to have the courage to engage on the plan and lead their people to a better future.
Jason Greenblatt, I have a million more questions that I could possibly ask you today. We could do this for a few more hours. If you had the time, and if it wasn't right before Rosh Hashanah, when people need to get ready for the holiday. So I think we're going to have to end here, but I want to say that I truly, truly appreciate it. I appreciate the support that we're getting here in Israel from you and from the entire administration. We feel it. We feel the love. I wish I could speak for everybody, which I can't, but it's truly, truly heartfelt to know that we have such good friends in the United States. And we really, really, really do appreciate it. So, Jason Greenblatt, assistant to U.S. President Donald Trump, special representative for international negotiations. I want to thank you for coming on the show today, Israel Uncensored, here on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com. And I want to wish you, your entire family, and the administration, and everyone who celebrates Rosh Hashanah, a sweet new year. Only good things in the coming year for you and your loved ones.
Josh, I want to thank you. I want to wish you and everybody who's listening a Shana Tova, a year of peace, a year of tranquility, a year of health and happiness, and echtiva v'chassima tova.
Amen. Thank you so much. This has been a special edition of Israel Uncensored here on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com for Friday, September 7th, 2018. And of course, big shout out to Binyamin Bresky, engineer extraordinaire. Without him, there's no sound. And also to Tabitha Epstein to make sure all of these audio files get up where they need to go. You know how to get in touch with me, Josh, at thelandofisrael.com. On Facebook, it is Joshua Haston. On Twitter, at Josh Haston. And thanks again to Jason Greenblatt for that amazing insight, amazing interview. To all the listeners out there, wishing you a Shana Tova from Israel. And between now and when we talk again, when we speak again, it'll be a week from Monday, since Monday is Rosh Hashanah. Everybody out there in the wonderful world of ours, be safe. Shalom, shalom from Israel. All the best. Shana Tova.
You're listening to the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com, broadcasting the truth and beauty of Israel to the world.